listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. Obviously, I am not Tom Hartman. Shano and I will be filling in for Tom today. He's out in Seattle at the Money, Politics, and Saving Our Democracy event. Yes Magazine's fourth annual celebration happening tonight in Seattle at 7:30. So if you are in the area, go over to yesmagazine.org or click the link on tomhartman.com and go out and see Tom, would ya? In the meantime, it is Friday, and we're going to be doing Tom's usual Anything Goes Friday.
And just think as a caller how much you can get away with us.
Yes.
Yeah, so
but
we look forward to the calls.
There are lots of important topics to cover as well. So we wanted to start right off the bat with Ian Millhiser, constitutional policy analyst at the Center for American Progress and the justice editor over at Think Progress blog, and the author of an upcoming book called Injustices, the Supreme Court's Nearly Unbroken History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Ian, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's good to be back. Thank you so much.
We always enjoy speaking with you. A couple weeks ago, the the D.C. Circuit withdrew their ruling regarding Obamacare subsidies. And you did a couple posts on that, but most importantly, you had an interview with somebody this would really, really affect. Can you tell us a little bit about Jennifer?
Sure thing. So what's at issue in this case is essentially whether the subsidies that make health insurance affordable in many states can continue to exist. And without those subsidies, it could wind up setting off what's called a death spiral, where the insurance markets collapse in many states in this country, at least the individual insurance markets do. I spoke with this woman, Jen, and it's such a sad story. She has cystic fibrosis. She recently had a lung transplant, which means she has to take anti-rejection drugs for the rest of her life, or else her immune system will attack her lungs and she'll die. The drugs she takes, just one of the drugs, and she takes three of them, cost nearly $2,400 a month if she doesn't have insurance. The transplant was a $280,000 surgery.
Wow.
She has an infection that she contracted when she got the lungs. Her lung donor had this infection, and every time it flares up, she can wind up having to take up to $4,500 worth of drugs just to tamp this infection down again. And she never knows when it's going to flare up. These are not prices that many people at all can afford to pay, and it's certainly not a price that she can afford to pay. You know, she and her husband are not rich. They need their insurance, and so it's so baffling to me that, you know, especially after we've already won this once in the Supreme Court, you've got judges who still think it's their job to take people's health insurance away from them. I hope that this case doesn't go anywhere, because it's not like Jen is alone with this story. And, you know, when you're taking away people's health insurance, in many cases, you're sentencing them to die.
Right. And in addition to people like Jennifer, who may have pre-existing conditions that were previously denied under, before the Affordable Care Act, there's still so many people in states that are stuck in that coverage gap who can't even get the insurance they need. Shouldn't we be moving towards insuring everybody and not suffering under a party and lawmakers and judges who seem absolutely adamant about continuing to try and kill this law?
Yeah, no, it is, you know, we shouldn't have to keep fighting this, you know, and it's not just in the courts. As you alluded to, you have millions of people who don't have coverage right now because state lawmakers refuse to accept the Medicaid expansion in their state. The Medicaid expansion is free money. You know, the federal government will give you, for right now, it's 100% of the money that the state needs in order to provide health care to many of its poorest citizens. Eventually, that goes down to only 90% of the money they need. So this is free money that these states are turning down because they don't like Obamacare. And again, what they are doing, you know, I mean, it's not just the Jen I can tell you about. I have all these stories of people who didn't have care because they couldn't afford it, and they died or they had horrible health conditions. I in my piece, I wrote about this brother and sister, George and Tina. Both of them worked. You know, George worked in a factory. Tina worked as a waitress. Both of them were productive taxpayers. And yet, because they didn't have health insurance, they had diabetes. They weren't able to manage their care, and they both died in their early 20s because they didn't have health insurance. You know, why would anyone say that we should continue to live in this world? And in the states where the health exchanges could collapse if this lawsuit succeeds, why would anyone say, you know what, we fixed that problem, and I want to bring that world back?
Yeah, it's really frustrating. Just in case anybody is not familiar with this case, the original ruling, which was, I believe, two Republican judges on
That's
the
right.
D.C. Circuit, ruled that states that did not set up their own exchanges shouldn't be eligible for federal subsidies. And now the D.C. Circuit has withdrawn that ruling. So what happens now, and what should people be concerned about?
Sure. So there's actually two parallel cases going on. There's one in what is called the Fourth Circuit, which is Maryland, Virginia, the Carolinas, and West Virginia. And that those judges said, you know, of course there should be subsidies here. You know, those judges said that everyone, no matter what state you live in, is entitled to subsidies under the Affordable Care Act if they qualify. These two Republican judges on the D.C. Circuit, which, as the name suggests, is the federal appeals court that oversees that oversees D.C., they decided to defund the law. And they said, based on a pretty egregious misreading of the law, they read one line out of context to say that only some states and not others are allowed to have these subsidies, that they were going to just defund most of the law, and in the process strip, you know, by one estimate I saw 6.5 million people of their health insurance. Now, like you said, the full D.C. Circuit has now withdrawn that opinion. A panel of 13 judges is going to hear the case in December, and that should be the end of it. You know what? That, you know, I'm fairly confident that a majority of those 13 judges are going to say, of course, there should be subsidies here. And once all the lower courts agree with each other, there's no reason whatsoever for the Supreme Court to take the case. You know, the only reason the Supreme Court would take this case is because, you know, most of the justices are Republicans and they don't like Obamacare. But barring a, you know, really political act by the Supreme Court, there's no legal reason for them to take the case. But it's still scary that this is hanging out there. You know, the idea that you would rip health care away from 6.5 million people is a terrifying prospect.
It certainly is, and it just shows how many important things are going on in our country that seem to just fall out of the news cycle and people forget about them. And we have to remember that this is an election year and these are the things we need to hold lawmakers accountable for. Ian, you have a book coming out. When can people pre-order that book? When can they expect to get a copy of Injustices?
So the book comes out in March, but I encourage you to order it now. If you just Google my name, M-I-L-L-H-I-S-E-R, and the word Injustices, the link will come up for Amazon or at my publisher where you can buy it. And, you know, what I explain in the book is how throughout history, the Supreme Court has really been, you know, it has been a malign institution. It has forced people to force children to work in cotton mills. And in one case, it allowed a woman to be sterilized.
Yep.
You know, it's been a very dangerous institution.
It certainly has, and I cannot wait to get my hands on a copy of that book. Thank you so much, Ian Millhiser, constitutional policy analyst, and you can check out all his amazing work over at thinkprogress.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What would you rather see Congress focusing on right now? Healthcare? Infrastructure? What are we forgetting about? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Danielle and Shano sitting in here for Tom today. He is out in Seattle. Just a let everyone know
yeah.
why we're here, obviously.
What
besides,
are they doing on our radio?
Besides Tom being in Seattle, we do obviously work for Tom. We're both producers
mm-hmm.
On the Tom Hartman program, but we also host our own show called Talking Left, which you can check out at talkingleft.com. It's on the station here in D.C., We Act Radio, as well as several other places where you can check it out online. We were just speaking with Ian Millhiser
yeah.
about a problem that is still huge. Millions of people stuck in a coverage gap, not getting health care. And it shows just one of the many issues we still have going on in this country that Congress will not vote on, talk about,
no.
take action on.
No. And they're very happy to let that one kind of go away. We've noticed that since Obamacare has started working in certain areas, that they don't want to talk about it as much. We'd much rather talk about, I guess now it's ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
And we have no problem spending $500 million without really debating it. We have a Congress that seems bent on going to war without calling it war, but at the same time, not even voting on it. You know, I'm really concerned that we have a Congress right now that wants to be a congressperson but doesn't want to do the duties of being a congressperson.
Yeah.
You know, if we're going to be going to do, you know, military action in the Middle East, don't you think they would want to say in that other than just complaining from the cheap seats? But they want to shirk their responsibilities on this. They don't want to deal with the Affordable Care Act and so many other things. And that's why you asked the question going into the break, what would you like to see the Congress debate, you know, including ISIS? Do you want them to be debating this? Do you want them to actually declare war as law requires?
Right. Even after, you know, big natural disasters like Hurricane Sandy, we had members of Congress come out and say that any emergency funding to help the victims of those tragedies had to be offset by major cuts
right.
in our budget. So why couldn't we say the same in the opposite direction? If the president and Congress are prepared to spend $500 million
mm-hmm.
to send more of our men and women into Iraq to fight again,
yes,
shouldn't we be spending some money on really important problems here at home? Crumbling infrastructure, you know, raising minimum wages, helping create government jobs, fixing health care. There are so many things that we could be spending money on. So,
and actually investing money.
Right.
Instead of spending money and then blowing that money up.
Right.
And it's just miraculous to me that the Congress just doesn't seem to want to do its job. And when you see their vote yesterday, when it comes to the amendment, the Udall amendment, like, you want to spend half your time, I guess, at home, a third of your time dialing for dollars, and the mm-hmm. rest of the time complaining.
Yes.
That's not the way our country, obviously, is not working very well that way. So that's why we're asking you, what would you like to see Congress do? And I want to call out to people and say, if you come across your congressperson or someone running for Congress, there's this old question that used to get asked of people running for office. If you ever watched The West Wing, it was called The Question. All right. And the question is, in the case of the West Wing, is why do you want to be president? And you would think, well, that should be a simple question to answer. But it isn't. So I want to ask the people in Congress, why do you want to be in Congress? If you don't want to vote and have a debate about going to war, why do you want to be there?
Right.
If you don't want to make this country better and work for the American people, why do you want to be there?
Yeah, we need some real answers on this, not just platitudes, not just talking points about because, you know, we have to stand up to the president or we have to kill Obamacare or, you know, some real concrete answers. Because if we can't get those from our lawmakers, why are they our lawmakers? We are coming up just a couple months away from a November election, our chance to speak out and, you know, vote, decide who should represent us. And these are the questions that we should be asking right now to find out whether or not they should be the ones representing us.
And amazingly, before this comes up, what does everyone seem to do? And I include the president among this. Take all of those main issues off of the table.
Right.
Let's Congress off of the hook. Immigration, don't worry about it. I'll do it later.
Right.
ISIS, don't worry about it. I've got authorization, which we could talk about if we want to.
Yes, we are going to get into that today. We're going to get into a lot of this stuff. Obviously, the Citizens United vote.
And the phones are, phones are ringing like crazy, but we will answer them this time. Last time we did this, you know, last minute, and we had way too many guests. We do have a number of guests, but we are going to take calls as well.
Right. Goes Friday, just like Tom usually does. So it's your chance to pick the topics. Please give us a call today. 1-866-987-TOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. We have a few great guests. We're going to be talking about net neutrality and the internet slowdown that happened this week, as well as the NSA and corporate power and all kinds of great
issues other than war.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that.
Great issues that Tom's listeners typically enjoy. But it is your day, so be sure to hang out with us there. Momentarily, we're going to speak with Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist, PBS producer, and the author of Who Stole the American Dream. He's going to be coming up next, and then we're going straight to the phones. So you're listening to Danielle and Shano sitting in here for Tom Hartman, and lots more in store today, so stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, coming up in just a few minutes. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and me, Danielle, sitting in for Tom today. When thinking about Tom's listeners and the topics that they love that Tom covers, we couldn't think of a better guest to speak with than Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist, PBS producer, and author of many books, including Who Stole the American Dream? Hedrick, thank you so much for joining us today. We really, really appreciate it.
Danielle, it's always great to be with you guys.
We always enjoy speaking with you. There was an article recently over at Think Progress that got my attention and made me really want to get your take on it. And it's titled, Workers Get the Lowest Share of Corporate Income Since 1950. In your book, Who Stole the American Dream, you talk a lot about the difference between stakeholders and shareholders. How do you think that difference plays into this difference in what workers are getting?
Well, this is a trend that's been going on a long time. And as you know, Danielle, the Fed just came out, the Federal Reserve just came out with a report saying that the share that workers are getting of the total national income is the lowest in 65 years, and the share that is going to corporate profits is the highest in 65 years. That's been building for a long time, and it's the result of a shift in the way American businesses are run and the mission of American businesses that's been taking place over the last 30 years. It's a shift from what I call stakeholder capitalism to shareholder capitalism. In the old days, when you talked to Charlie Wilson at General Motors or Reg Jones at General Electric or Frank Abrams at Standard Oil in New Jersey, all big, capitalistic, profitable companies, their idea was that the company did better, the economy did better, when they, as the CEOs, took care of all the stakeholders in the company, and that meant not just the shareholders, but the workers, the managers, the suppliers, the bankers, the creditors, the customers. And today, the focus is strictly on shareholders. What they do is they try to deliver the highest dividends and the highest stock price to the shareholders, and then everybody else has to get what's left over. There's a really interesting new paper out in the Harvard Business Review that absolutely nails this, and the numbers, when I read them, are staggering. They document what I was reporting in my book, but this is even more precise. This economist from the University of Massachusetts reported that back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, during that era, companies took about 54% of their profits, and they returned them to shareholders in the form of dividends and payouts of one kind or another. And they took almost the other half, 46%, and they invested in the growth of the company, research and development, expanding into new areas of business and new sectors of the economy, training workers, and actually sharing profits with workers. Today, Lazanovich, this economist, went through the Fortune 500 companies, and they give 91% of their profits to the shareholders, either in the form of dividends or what are called stock buybacks, where the company goes into the market and buys back its own stock in order to jack, because it reduces the supply, demand goes up, the stock price goes up, and the CEO and lots of the top executives are getting most of their pay in stock prices, so they're giving themselves a raise. And meanwhile, only 9% is going into research and development, growth, and paying more to the workers and training the workers.
Wow.
Huge difference.
That is stunning.
Versus 46%.
Yeah.
And that's why you've got workers getting so much less. People, the big guys in the companies, are paying themselves back, and they're paying Wall Street back, and they're not sharing the wealth with ordinary workers.
Well, in addition to not sharing the wealth with workers, doesn't that actually harm companies in the long run, as well as, you know, things like our environment, our national electric grid, things that businesses used to take pride in, pay higher taxes, you know, pay workers more money, pay for better research and development, in addition to really hurting workers, hurting middle class families and jobs? Isn't there a bigger picture here of that this policy, how is it sustainable in the long term?
Well, you're absolutely right. There is a much bigger impact. I mean, you've got lots of economic studies out by economists like Joe Stiglitz at Columbia University, and I was reporting that when you have high inequality of income and when companies spend that much money on paying back shareholders, it hurts growth. It hurts the growth of the company. It hurts the growth of the country. And the International Monetary Fund has similar studies around the world. I mean, economists have taken a look at this. There's no question. The thing that's interesting is if you look at the slow growth we've had coming out of the recession of 2008, some of it is due to what we're talking about right now. Companies have been sitting on money. Major American companies have been sitting on $2 trillion. Since 2000, they spent $3 trillion in buying back their own stock instead of investing it in new products and their own growth. So that's one of the reasons why we have slow growth today. Yeah, there's no question that this is hurting the economy. In fact, if you go back and talk to the and look at the writings of the guys who were running companies in America, the big companies in America back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they said paying the workers better and investing in our own future is smart business and good economics for the country. So, I mean, people understood that. Today, they don't want to talk about that. Part of the problem is that the multinationals can move a lot of their profits and their business overseas, and even if the American economy isn't doing well, they're making money in China or Japan or Malaysia or Singapore or what have you. So they're disconnected from our economy. So, yes, there's no question. It's a harmful thing for companies not to be reinvesting. Think about it.
Yeah.
91% of their returns every year, they're paying out to their shareholders. Well, they don't have that money around to build their own companies, to invest in new technology, to build growth.
Yeah.
It's not smart long-term strategy.
It's
slowing down American growth.
It certainly doesn't make any sense to me. I want to quickly remind everybody, we're speaking with Hedrick Smith, New York Times journalist, producer, PBS producer, and author of Who Stole the American Dream? There was a story, a rather big story a few weeks ago that I just wanted to get your take on while we had the chance to speak with you. And it was the story of a New England supermarket chain called Market Basket. So often, progressives, myself included, think of good labor practices solely as unionized labor practices. But in the case of Market Basket, treating their employees well paid off, treating them, as you would say, like stakeholders. Did you have any thoughts on that story?
Yeah, my reaction to that story is, when are customers, workers, and particularly bosses going to wake up? This is a marvelous story, Market Basket. It's a marvelous story. There was this guy, Artie DeMoulis, who was running the company. It was a family-owned company, a chain of about 70 supermarkets all around New England, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine, all that area there. And he was treating his employees well. He was giving them better starting wages than you get at Walmart and other supermarket chains. He was actually delivering lower prices. He was generating, believe it or not, this was very profitable. He was generating lots of profits for the owners. And what we found out, his cousin was running the company and owned a little bit more of it than DeMoulis. He threw DeMoulis out because he wanted more. It was typical shareholder capitalism. They wanted more earnings. They wanted to give less to the employees. So they fired Artie DeMoulis, and the employees were so loyal to him, they walked out. They walked out en masse of the stores, and customers started to boycott the new management, and mayors in about 100 towns recommended that customers boycott it. So what had happened was the stakeholder form of capitalism that Adi de Moulas was practicing, worker-friendly, customer-friendly, built such loyalty that people stopped working with the other company until de Moulas could buy his way back in, buy out his cousin, and now the customers are flocking back. In fact, they've got all kinds of new customers because this fight was going on for about 6 or 8 weeks up this summer up in New England, and a whole lot of people who'd never shopped at Market Basket said, hey, this must be a great place. What are they doing there?
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine?
They're getting a whole lot of unintended but free advertising about running a good business. The answer to me is if you treat people right, you get really good loyalty out of your employees. They serve the customers well. The customers come back. In fact, you've got some other companies like that now. Gap has announced it's going to increase the minimum wage of its workers around the country. Why? Because the boss says we're going to get more loyalty, less turnover from our workers, better service for our customers. It's going to profit the company in the long run.
Yeah.
Hey, wake up, guys. It's out there. Let's reclaim the American dream. Let's go back to a system of capitalism where there's sharing of the wealth, there's decent treatment of employees, customers are more happy, and there's a better interchange and more profits and more growth.
Yeah,
it was a formula that worked in this country for 30 or 40 years. Why'd we give it up?
It's,
we stole the American dream, and that was crazy.
It's absolutely common sense to me, and it shows. I mean, imagine if this was a company the size of Walmart, where you had millions of workers that were willing to support the company they work for, buy American, support American businesses and American jobs, simply because they were treated well. It's not rocket science that when people are treated well, they will return the favor. Hedrick, where can people...
There is a company like that.
Yep.
And it's called Costco.
Excellent point.
And it pays its workers $2 or $3 an hour more. It retains its workers. It does not have a lot of worker turnover. It has a lot of customer loyalty. It is actually a more profitable company. It's a smaller company than Walmart, but it's a more profitable company than Walmart. The longtime CEO of that company, the Walmart CEO in the last 10 years or so, every year has taken about $20 million in pay.
Yep.
Walmart is owned mostly by the members of the Walton family, the heirs of Sam Walton.
Absolutely.
So they get a big payout for their shareholders. They get a big payout.
Hedrick,
Senegal.
Absolutely, absolutely. Really appreciate speaking with you. Hedrick Smith, everybody, author of Who Stole the American Dream. You can find out where to get it at HedrickSmith.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Easy to see why we enjoy speaking with Hedrick Smith so much. He'll get you fired up just like Tom. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Danielle and Shano sitting in here, and we're
going to take some free speech calls.
Taking some free speech calls because we want to get to you. It's Friday, and it's your day. So we will go to, let's see, Ross in East Carbon, Utah. Thanks for calling the Tom Hartman Program, Ross.
Hi, how are you guys doing today? I love you. I love Tom Hartman and Stephanie Miller and Carl Frisch and all the liberals out there.
Yeah, I do as well. You had
absolutely.
some thoughts on the Medicaid expansion.
I do. I live in Utah, where we are. We were one of the states that fought the Medicaid expansion through our attorney. You know, to take it to Supreme Court. And my wife has what they call oxygen-deprived myiac illness. It's her oxygen was cut off the right side of her brain when she was born. Oh. And they wanted to do a deep brain stimulator to maybe help control that movement on the right side. But the state says they won't pay for it.
Well, Ross, wouldn't that be an excellent, I mean, certainly, sorry to hear about your wife. And I would definitely recommend to appeal and call your congressman. People see what they can do. Let them know that these are issues that people are having out there. But
you don't understand. One of our senators is Mike Lee, and the other one's our congressman person that is in the House is Chaffetz, whatever his name
is. Wow.
Well, at last time I checked, conservatives like to call themselves pro-life.
Yeah.
So maybe it's time they should, you know, start listening.
So Utah itself has not taken the Affordable Care Act expansion, is that right?
Yeah, they're on that. Well, the governor's trying to do it a different way, but the legislature's fighting it, you know, because we're one of them Tea Party states, you know.
Well, with Chaffetz and Mike Lee, I can see that. But normally, you know, we would suggest calling your federal, but this sounds more like something that's in the state legislature and calling there. How are your representatives at the state level? Like you said, I know Tea Party, but...
They're fighting this. You know, the governor wants to do it a different way. I don't know how he wants to do it.
Well, Ross, maybe you should think about running.
What I think is going to happen is...
disabled. I'm on oxygen 24 hours a day. I can't afford to... You know, be out on the street. I have a COPD, chronic bronchitis.
Hopefully, there are people listening who, you know, hear Ross's situation and would help in a fight like that.
But also, in terms of this, what's going to happen is as there are states that are taking the expansion, and as your neighbor states expand, and then the people of those states that are next door see all the benefits of it, there's going to be building political pressure that even Tea Party state legislators cannot buck.
Yep.
I mean, it will eventually expand. I know that doesn't help you right at this moment, but I'm hoping that, you know, as the plan goes into place more and more and more, people are going to start demanding it.
Yeah, and I think people like Ross and his wife have every right to demand it. You know, we were speaking with Ian about Jennifer. And Ross, thank you very much for calling and for watching Free Speech TV. And, you know, just keep letting people know. Let your local lawmakers know. Let your local papers know. And hopefully people in your area will help out as well. Lots more calls Shane and I will be taking today. 866-987-THOM. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Big thanks to Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist. He's covered some amazing stuff. You should definitely go check out Hedrick Smith.
Pulitzer Prize winner, Emmy winner.
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
Yeah. This question of corporations viewing people as stakeholders or shareholders, I think it plays into so many aspects, including the ISIS aspect. If corporations still viewed people as stakeholders, viewed our government, our soldiers, our lawmakers, our environment as stakeholders, wouldn't they be willing to pay a little higher taxes to cover the cost of a war?
Well, that's an interesting question because we watched the president's speech on Wednesday night. And if you look back at presidents prior, especially if you to look at someone like FDR, who actually we had a situation where we were attacked, we declared war the last time we declared it. When FDR spoke about it, it wasn't even just about rallying the American support for the war. It was also, here's the sacrifices we're all going to have to make. And we've lost that part of war in this country. We've made war very simple for a vast majority of this country. Very small percentage of the families in this country send their sons and daughters off to war.
Yeah.
You know, so many people in this country, of those 60 to 70% who say, yeah, let's bomb ISIS. Woo-hoo, go America. Also, after they get done filling out that poll that gets us to 60%, then goes to the mall.
Yeah.
You know, or turns on reality TV or whatever. And there are families out there that are sending their kids into combat.
Yes.
You know, and
absolutely. So. These are all things that we need to remind lawmakers about in November. Dwayne, in Michigan, you had some thoughts about that upcoming election. Dwayne, listening on Sirius?
Yes. I don't really feel that the Democrats are serious about taking back the House or saving the Senate. If they wanted to win, they could just go out there and run on voter suppression alone, and they could flood the polls. They could have the commercials out there showing all these lawmakers from across the nation, all the Republicans, stating you know why they want photo ID. The guy from Pennsylvania stating that they just gave Pennsylvania to Romney with the photo ID. the guy in the Carolinas who said, no, we're not discriminating against blacks. We're elected Democrats.
Yeah, I think some of them. Yeah, I think some of them are, Dwayne. I don't know if you're familiar with the recent ruling in Ohio. A judge struck down the voter suppression laws there and opened it up really close to when their early voting starts, just a couple of weeks. But the Democrats in that state have been out there, you know, stumping for the rights of voters, making sure that they have access to the early voting that they should have. I agree with you. It's a very important issue when you tell somebody that you're going to take away their rights.
Yeah, and look what happened last time they did this. People showed up
more. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, they just said, don't you dare take my right to vote away. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
If a Democrat went out there and said that, you know, if you're a Democrat and you're too busy, lazy, or stupid to vote in 2014, you may not vote in 2016, they could take back everything.
Yep.
And, it's not, you know, I know there's individual Democratic organizations out there that are doing good work.
Oh,
I'm talking about the National Party. Because, you know, you could get a dozen congressmen out there in front of a podium, and someone will have to listen. And if you keep saying this, and you keep saying that voter suppression is un-American, it's pushed by the Koch brothers, it's written by Alec, and implemented by the Republicans, it seems like they could just wipe everything out.
Yeah, well, Dwayne, you just said it to...
I like that riff.
Yeah, I really like that riff.
Pushed by the Koch brothers, written by Alec, and I love that.
Yeah, and Dwayne, you just said it to about a million people, so hopefully some lawmakers are listening. I think you make an excellent point.
And there is an issue, though. He said, why don't we flood the market with a bunch of ads about this?
Yeah, costs.
Well, here we go. Well, now we're back to Citizens United again.
Right.
And the vote that happened yesterday where Republicans didn't even vote to allow a vote.
Yeah.
You know, this was filibustered.
According to Vox.com, it was a little different than a filibuster because it's a proposed amendment. So they actually needed the 67 votes.
Got it.
Something I mistook when speaking to people yesterday. We get so used to...
Yeah, we get so used to the cloture vote. So,
right.
So they didn't have to vote to end debate.
Right.
So this was just a vote, and we needed 2/3.
Right. And they didn't get it. It was a party line vote. 54 Democrats voted to advance the amendment to overturn Citizens United. But just think about the success in that. When was the last time we had a debate over a constitutional amendment?
They
let
went
alone,
all the way to a vote.
Right. Let alone to get money out of politics. I mean,
right.
Why aren't you talk about...
And it wasn't really a debate about locking up Lauren Michaels.
Yes.
Like Ted Cruz said.
Let's see who else we have on the board here. Thomas, listening in Englewood, Colorado, you had a suggestion of what you'd like to see $500 million spent on?
Greetings, yes. I would like to see them invade America. If they want to start war, why don't we just start finding a city or state that's like doing so bad, like the state of Detroit, and spend $1 trillion on rebuilding that city up, and then after that one's rebuilt, go on to another city.
I certainly think before we're doing nation building in another country, which is always the term, you know, that is more helpful than blowing stuff up first and foremost.
Right.
But we've got plenty of nation building to do here at home.
Yeah. And I know I'd treat my people like liberators when they come and start to rebuild my city. And Iraqis didn't treat us like liberators.
Thomas, it's an excellent point. Thank you very much for listening on Sirius and for giving us a call today. We are sitting here filling in for Tom Hartman, Danielle, and Shano. You can check out our show over at talkingleft.com. You can get it on iTunes. It's free.
And it's starting on Progressive Voices this weekend.
Yes.
The Progressive Voices on Channel and TuneIn, which many of you may be listening to this show on right now.
Right. You can listen right there on Sunday. Very exciting. And we are going to keep going with Anything Goes Friday. So be sure to give us a call. Let us know what you want to talk about at 866-987-TOM, 866-987-THOM. We still have so much to talk about. We've really barely touched on the ISIS stuff. Want to get your thoughts on the internet slowdown and net neutrality and NSA surveillance. Just there's so many topics in the news that it's hard to cover them all in 3 hours. Next hour, we're going to play a little bit of an interview we did for you with Cindy Cohen, the general counsel and legal director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, about the chances of finally getting a vote on the constitutionality of NSA surveillance. But first, we're going to go right back to your calls.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Me, Danielle, and Shano, hosts of Talking Left, sitting in for Tom today. Tom is out in Seattle. And
right, he's on his way, I think.
Yes, yes. But if you're in Seattle or in the surrounding area, don't miss the Money, Politics, and Saving Our Democracy event featuring Tom himself. It's being put on by Yes Magazine as their fourth annual celebration, and it's happening tonight at 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall, Seattle. And for more information, you can check it out at yesmagazine.org or click the link on the front of tomhartman.com. So definitely check that out.
We have a lot of listeners. Tom has a lot of listeners out there.
Yeah,
so
especially in that area. So show up if you can, and I'm sure Tom will be thrilled to see you there.
Absolutely.
We had a little clip, Shane, President Obama.
The president has been talking about his authority to go after ISIS in Iraq and in Syria. And, of course, he gave a speech on this. He met with congressional leaders about this. And out of that meeting, he said, yeah, I have the power to do this. And there are a few people going around, and we've seen them as the debate is going on television, not really on the floor of Congress. The debate is whether or not the president has the authority to do this. And he has said that under the original authorization to use military force against Al-Qaeda that was given to Bush, that's where he's getting the go-ahead to do this.
Right.
And why he doesn't need Congress to give him the okay to do this. So we have a clip of the president talking about the authorization of use of military force right here. I want you to hear it.
Now, all these issues remind us that the choices we make about war can impact, in sometimes unintended ways, the openness and freedom on which our way of life depends.
So the impacts here at home of war.
And that is why I intend to engage Congress about the existing authorization to use military force.
Interesting.
Or AUMF.
Interesting.
To determine how we can continue to fight terrorism without keeping America on a perpetual wartime footing. The AUMF is now nearly 12 years old.
It sounds so great, doesn't it?
I love it.
The Afghan war is coming to an end.
Cool.
Or Al-Qaeda is a shell of its former self.
Perfect.
Groups like AQAP must be dealt with, but in the years to come, not every collection of thugs that labels themselves Al-Qaeda will pose a credible threat to the United States.
Credible threat. Notice he says credible.
Unless we discipline our thinking, our definitions, our actions, we may be drawn into more wars we don't need to fight. Or continue to grant presidents unbound powers more suited for traditional armed conflicts between nation states. So I look forward to engaging Congress and the American people in efforts to refine and ultimately repeal the AUMF's mandate.
Doesn't that sound amazing?
Yeah.
There's just one problem. It's from 2013.
Yeah.
It's from last year. So that was what the president said last year about the authorization for use of military force.
Which he is now using as his justification for not seeking approval from Congress to bomb in Iraq and possibly Syria.
Right. Now, we know what the political situation is and that Congress doesn't want to vote. But it's
interesting. I think to an extent he's worried about what he's going to get.
Right.
with that vote.
Yeah.
Because you have different factions in there. Some people who are so warmongery that they want to give unlimited, unbridled power to him. The other ones who are very worried about this executive expansion, especially when, you know, it's Obama. You know, we can't give him too much power. We sue him over having too much power, so we can't give him any more. So that debate going back and forth, they may come up with nothing. And then what do you do? Or if they vote no, then what do you do?
Look what happened with Syria. The first time. Remember, we're going back.
I liked that.
Hey, if they can use the 12-year-old AUMF to say we can, 13-year-old now at this point, to say we can go into Syria and bomb them, why can't we use the last time Congress was asked to vote and said don't go into Syria and bomb them? Just saying. I mean, if their old stuff is as good as our old stuff, why can't we use that one? Donald in Chicago has some thoughts on that. Donald, you are a veteran, and you had some thoughts on this situation?
Oh, yes, I sure do. You know, I voted for President Obama, and I think he's one of the greatest presidents we ever had. But the truth of the matter is, he made a comment one time. He said, never do anything stupid. Well, he's doing something stupid now. The thing is, and if he's going to go this route, he better get Congress's approval. Get their feet in the door, put the ball in their court, and if they say no and they don't, if they vote no, pull all the troops out. Get us out of there. Because if he starts a war, it's going to go beyond his term.
Right.
He's going to leave us with what we were left off with Bush and Cheney. And when those clowns in the Republican right get a hold of this, believe me, it's going to cause major problems for this country. We are going to be at war all the time, and he should repeal that
AUMF.
He talked about what's it called again?
It's the Authorization for Use of Military Force.
It was specifically against Al Qaeda,
right.
And what the justification is now is that they're saying that, and what the president is saying is that ISIS was born from. Now they've broken up since. You know, they have a rocky relationship, and in fact, Al Qaeda is against ISIS. But since it came from, therefore, this covers it. It's they're really stretching the language of the AUMF to justify this.
Well,
but the thing is, you don't have a Congress who's saying, hey, you're stretching the language too much. They're saying, fine, we have an election, we're going home.
Yeah, in fact, you have a Congress that doesn't want to say anything at all. Donald, thank you very much for the call and for your service. We certainly appreciate it, and thanks for listening to WCPT. How about we'll go with John in Minneapolis. John, you had some thoughts on what we were talking to Ian about, universal health care and coverage.
Yes. Leading up to Obamacare Act, or not the Obamacare Act, but the Affordable Care Act, the insurance companies spent over $700 million. I don't even think that was a full year that they were lobbying against having universal health care, because, you know, obviously the money has to go to the corporations, and we're left with whatever is left over. And, you know, this is a problem. And I would say, you know, money talks, democracy walks. If we don't get money out of politics, which was, you know, a part of that amendment that you guys were talking about, you know, we're just never going to get anywhere, because there is a war. The war is that they're at war with us. They want to take everything. They essentially, what they're saying to people, that 6 million people who will be thrown off the insurance rolls, is why don't you die and decrease the excess population? And I work in healthcare, and I can tell you how frustrating it is to be constantly given more and more work, because they're already ratcheting down the amount that they reimburse, and people aren't aware of this.
Right.
Medicare is giving less and less money to hospitals to take care of people, and they are literally working people into the ground. And, you know, the powers that be could care less. The administration, as long as they get, you know, the people that administer health care, as long as they get their cut, they're silent about it.
Yeah, it's not just Medicare. It's, you know, commercial insurance as well. I worked insurance in healthcare and in insurance for a long time, John, and seeing where one of the big problems are is what insurance companies reimburse doctors and hospitals. And I got to tell you, that was 10 years before the Affordable Care Act. It had nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act.
Medicare pays less. the insurance companies, it's a spiral downward. But I want to say also, look at the money that we're spending for wars.
Right.
Trillions and trillions of dollars into war that benefits nobody. And then also the National Security Agency, I mean, they can't even tell us what they actually do. What a great gig that is.
If all of us could be so lucky, and we are going to talk about that actually in just a few moments from now, but we're going to keep getting your calls, your topics. It is Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Big thanks to John. They're listening at tomhartman.com from Minneapolis. Give us a call. What's on your mind? 866-987-THOM.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, what would you like to see money invested in? And is the authorization of use in military force still valid? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, to our Free Speech TV audience. So we'll go with Steve, listening or watching on Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Rochester, New York.
Hey,
hi,
my
Steve.
Hometown. Hey, Steve.
Hi. You were just talking about the voter thing, where there's a number of voter registration acts.
Okay.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
About the voter registration what? I'm sorry?
Well, you know, all these moves to you call it suppression of votes.
Yes. I think that's a pretty fair term. Do you disagree with that?
No. I think we ought to define a few things, though. I think you'd agree that we should have fair elections. They should be fair.
Okay.
Although,
who gets to define what fair means?
Pardon me?
I said, who gets to define what fair means?
Oh, well, that's a very good point. By fair in a democracy, I would think that it would be the qualified voters voting in an area. For instance, the town I live in. I don't want people in the surrounding towns coming in and voting for my selectman or my mayor.
And do you think that there's actually a problem with that, Steve? Have you seen any evidence that people from surrounding areas have come into Rochester, New York, and voted?
I'm up in my 80s there, and I've seen a lot of it.
Okay, so obviously you support the voter ID is what you're getting at, right?
What I'm getting at is that we have to ensure that we don't have a couple of things like people that aren't in an area of voting, and I don't care whether it's for mayor or president or selectman or senators. You only should be able to vote in the area where you live, and
right.
You only have one place to live.
Yeah.
For instance, if you live near a state line, you can't vote for president in New York.
Yeah,
right. Steve, I actually grew up in Rochester, New York, so I know exactly how voting works in that area. I've voted many, 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 many times. You have to register. You also have to sign when you vote. So when you register, you're registering with an address. And when you walk into that polling place, that is only for the elections that you have registered for, and only those people who you've registered for can you vote for. You have to then sign your name. And the polling people, they don't show it. They cover up the old signature that you used on your registration card. Then you sign your name, and then they compare the two. Signatures are very distinct. That's how they do it in there. And I've never heard of any cases, any prosecuted cases in my hometown area. If you have any, let me know. Any prosecuted ones in our area of people coming across an area and voting in the other elections. Do you have any of those?
Yes, I do.
You're prosecuted by?
I grew up and I live in. Well,
go ahead.
Okay, look at. I grew up in Boston under the Curly machine.
No.
And I know how things work. Now, when you're talking about here in Rochester, people have to sign their name mm-hmm. when they go to vote, and they compare it.
Right.
And they do a fairly decent job here in Rochester.
Yeah.
But don't tell me that it can't be cheated on.
Yeah, Steve, it's just this is an issue that has been gone through so many times.
Litigated.
And if there were these cases out there, Republicans would have them on the front page of every newspaper in the country. It just doesn't happen. We'll be
certainly
right back.
Certainly not very often.
the Tom Hartman Program. Danielle and Shano of Talking Left sitting in for Tom today while he is...
And of the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, the Tom Hartman Program while he is in Seattle. And we, in the next few minutes, we're going to play you some interview tape we had with the General Counsel and Legal Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation about the National Security Agency. But in the meantime, we do want to...
National Surveillance Agency better, quite honestly.
I think it's more accurate.
Isn't it?
Yeah. But in the meantime, we are going with your calls. It's Anything Goes Friday. So let's get to Matt, listening at TomHartman.com in Graysville, Pennsylvania. Matt, you had some thoughts on Congress.
Yeah, hi. Great show today. I also love listening to you both on Talking Left as well.
Well, thanks.
I just want to say for Congress in general, it's when you go to pick an issue, it's like immigration, gun control, health care, war authority, anything. I mean, with a 13 to 14% approval rating, I would be happy if they did anything at this point.
Yeah, the last approval rating I remember it was a couple months ago, was at 7%.
And that's pretty much friends and family.
Yes. Yeah, that's the friends and family approval rating.
Yeah, also in their cell phone plans.
Yeah,
that's
what can we do about it? I mean, just yesterday, Congress essentially refused to vote on a constitutional amendment to get money out of politics. Don't you think getting corporations and corporate power out of the system would help get some of these things done?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt corporate America runs so much. That would be fantastic.
And since corporate America is doing so well right now,
yeah,
why in the world would they want anything changed? Why would they want Congress? Things are just great for them. I mean, so it reflects Congress's inaction actually reflects probably the will of the corporations at this point. Wouldn't you think?
It does. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, something needs to change. I mean, I think most of America is just so unhappy with Congress in general at this point.
Yeah, it's just I don't like to buy in, and it's hard. I can't do it all the time. But I don't like to buy into the it's frustrating, both sides are the same, so I'm not going to do anything. Because our system was designed by brilliant men to make it so that we could do something, so that we had a system that we could fix when it got broken. And as we can all see, it's pretty darn broken at the moment. And it's up to us.
Yeah, the more broke it is, the more we need to do.
Yeah. Matt, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because all the money, all the time, all the effort that people take to put these people in a position of power in Congress, and then they turn around and just, there's inactivity. They do nothing. I mean,
yeah,
that's what they were hired to do.
I know. They work less days than probably anybody out there, but somehow they still have a job, and somehow they still criticize the president for taking vacation. I'm not quite sure how that works. But, Matt, thank you very much for listening and for giving us a call here on the Tom Hartman Program.
All right.
All right.
Show, guys. Thank you.
Let's go with Larry in Tucson, Arizona. Larry, you had what you'd like to see the money being spent on war.
I see war as a systemic result of, you know, one group or another having lack. And so I think a lot of problems could be resolved by employing infrastructure in the United States as sustainable gardening techniques. And I'm a peacetime veteran who's had to deal with the VA, come in contact with a lot of veterans who are pretty much unemployable, as are a lot of people unemployable in today's economy.
Yeah.
But you purify water when you use a sustainable gardening system. So if we collect water, put it in a sustainable or organic system, and I worked in a training environment in the military. We can train people to pick up, do anything from pick up leaves to fly sophisticated aircraft and everything in between.
Yep.
So we could train people how to use these new sustainable systems indoor and outdoor. We could put our vets in gardens on air bases or army bases surrounded by their psychologists, their therapists, their prosthetic experts, all the support they need.
Yeah, I think that would be a much more appropriate way to treat our veterans instead of forgetting them. Forgetting them when they get home.
In Arizona, 1 in 3 children or 1 in 4 children is hungry. You know, so we need to feed people.
Right, and that is yet again we're investing in something. Instead of buying something and blowing it up, we're investing in people, we're investing in the environment, and we have an output, which is food. So those are the types of things that $500 million could go a long way towards. And we're not just giving someone a job. We're also helping them psychologically to the damage that we've caused by all the wars we put them in.
Right.
Am I still on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, because the way it relates to war is if we have systems filled with young people, medium-aged people, old people who know how to set up sustainable systems, I would rather show up in a Tunisia or a Syria or an Iraq where people are suffering from lack and have C-141s unloading excellent topsoil and technicians to set up gardening and water purification systems and medical stations, and then have a small military crew to protect everybody coming in and out.
Well, Larry, and you also said something that makes me think of a point Tom often makes, and he says, I'll paraphrase probably badly, but when the last people who remember how something's done, when they pass on and we don't have that guidance and that knowledge anymore, if it doesn't get passed down, we lose it. And, you know, linking, as you said, young people with old people doing working with nature, working with gardens.
Build gardens, not bombs.
Yeah, build gardens, not bombs. Hey, food, not bombs.
There you go.
As many people have said before. But, Larry, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Tucson, Arizona. We're going to come back with some of our interview with Cindy Cohen, General Counsel and Legal Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. You may not have heard much about it, but
it's a big deal.
It's a big deal. The NSA surveillance, the ruling on constitutionality has reached its highest court to actually hear the case.
Not a technicality.
Yeah, not on a technicality, but actually listen to lawyers argue about whether or not it's constitutional. We're going to play some of that for you next and continue with your calls at 866-987-TOM.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Are we focusing enough on the NSA? Is that one of those issues that seems to have dropped out of the media? 866-987-TOM. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Me, Danielle, and Shano sitting in for Tom today. We had the pleasure last night of speaking with Cindy Cohen, the General Counsel and Legal Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, about a recent NSA case. We're going to play some of that for you right now. The NSA constitutionality question actually got a pretty decent hearing before a high-level court. So we wanted to speak with Cindy Cohen, the General Counsel and Legal Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. You can check them out at EFF.org. Cindy, thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks to you.
So you, I'm guessing, are fairly familiar with this case.
It's true, and I was lucky enough to get to attend the hearing last week in New York.
That's amazing. Can you give a little background on why it's been so hard to get a constitutionality ruling on surveillance programs?
Well, I mean, you know, we started suing over the NSA spying in 2006, and until last June, which is a very important date, we were being tied up by the government on a number of arguments having to do with the great need for secrecy, you know, such a great need for secrecy that the courts couldn't even decide whether something was legal or not, and a bunch of procedural arguments around legal doctrines like immunity, qualified immunity, and things like that. So those things were really tying us up for a long time, and we weren't losing, at least EFF cases weren't losing, but it was very, very, very slow. Of course, last June, the world changed a lot with Mr. Snowden's revelations, and equally important from our perspective, the government actually finally admitting things like the telephone records collection and some of the other surveillance. That shift meant that the government couldn't really argue secrecy in the same way that they'd argued before and teed up the cases for a more straightforward constitutional one. The first series of those, including the one last week for the ACLU, focuses on the telephone records collection. And, you know, courts move slowly, but honestly, it's been just a little over a year, and we now have constitutional decisions out of three courts, And one of them has gone up on appeal. So, you know, in the glacial world of legal precedents, that's actually fairly quick for a year.
Yeah, absolutely. In the ACLU versus Clapper case, they're saying that the government spying exceeds constitutional authority under the Patriot Act. If I have read this correctly, I'm certainly no legal scholar. How is it that they claim that language under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, like any tangible reason, any tangible thing a reason to spy on someone, how on earth is that in line with the Constitution?
Well, I mean, there's kind of two arguments going on here. One is that the statute doesn't even authorize mass surveillance. So the language of any tangible things reasonably related to an investigation, that doesn't say, you know, you can spy on everybody first and then sort out second who you really need. That's language that actually looks like a lot of other things like subpoenas and grand jury things that are supposed to be targeted, that are targeted. So the first argument the ACLU has isn't a constitutional one, which is this particular statute doesn't authorize mass surveillance at all. That's not what those words mean, and the government's attempts to try to stretch those words to let them do mass surveillance is just not right, that the statute doesn't do that. So that's step one. And then the second argument they make is that this mass surveillance, even if the statute could let this happen, that violates the Constitution because the Constitution requires the government to have a probable cause warrant or a much greater showing than the statute allows before it can get access to this information. And, you know, the government's argument on the other side is, well, it doesn't count under the Fourth Amendment because it's not content. It's, you know, just the numbers you dial, how often you dial them, how often you talk to everybody and who you talk to. And that's kind of central to the constitutional analysis, is this non-content information, the government calls it metadata, but this information that is, you know, all the information around the content of your communications, does it count for purposes of constitutional protections or not? And that's really the first constitutional step that we all have to go through to get to a real ruling. And it was center stage in the discussion last Tuesday.
Now, I want to quickly remind everybody, we're speaking with Cindy Cohen, the general counsel and legal director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, one of the groups, by the way, that has been first and foremost out front trying to protect our privacy rights. So this case was heard before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Is that the highest level an NSA surveillance case has reached thus far?
Yes. Well, yes, about the Section 215 program. You know, the ACLU, in a case called Amnesty International v. Clapper, questioned the NSA surveillance statute, the FISA Amendments Act, on its face when it was first passed in 2008. And that went to the Supreme Court, but it didn't go to the Supreme Court on the question of whether the statute itself was consistent with the constitutionality. It ended up being decided on whether there was standing, whether anybody could, the people who sued had the reasonable basis to challenge it. And the Supreme Court, in what I think is a very disappointing decision, said that because the program was secret, the ACLU couldn't know whether the Amnesty International, the ACLU plaintiffs, couldn't know whether they were actually being spied on, so therefore they couldn't challenge the statute. So the court didn't address whether the statute itself was constitutional in that decision. They just decided what you needed to know in order to be able to sue under it. Does that make sense? It's kind of legal games there.
Absolutely. It seems like a lot of judges, including our nation's highest court, have kind of played those legal games right along with the government, as you mentioned, state secrets, standing, et cetera. And I'm kind of worried about the possibility of that happening again. We saw recently President Obama address the surveillance programs, said many things were changing. Is there any concern that the, in my opinion, weak reforms that were passed, the small changes that were made, moot any of the ongoing cases, including ACLU versus Clapper, or at least on the government's behalf, that they're going to try and argue the program's no longer in place, thus the case is moot?
Well, I think so far the tiny changes that the Obama administration made don't moot the case, and the government isn't even arguing that they are. If the USA Freedom Act passes, the one that Senator Leahy has been floating, then I think there will be a serious evaluation about whether the ACLU's case can continue, because the program will, you know, it's a small reform, but it'll change pretty dramatically some things. You know, whether that's enough for us or whether it's the kind of change we want to see, I think there's an honest debate about. But it will mean that the government can't do mass collection anymore. They'll have to query the phone companies for the information. And that's a big enough change that the program will be quite different than, you know, the one that the ACLU sued over. And then the question of whether they're going to have standing to challenge the new case, the new situation will come up. So it's possible if the pending law passes that there will be an attempt to try to undermine these cases. But right now there hasn't been enough change by the Obama administration to merit that concern just yet. At least the government's not arguing it yet.
Well, that certainly provides some relief to me, at least, because it was a big worry for me. I feel like the government keeps throwing legal hurdles in the way here, so we never get a broad, sweeping ruling from a powerful court. With all of the pressure on this, all of the great groups, you know, EFF, you guys, the ACLU, Free Press, so many groups in this fight, do you think that there will come a time when we get that broad, sweeping ruling saying that this is a violation of the Constitution?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, you know, this is what I've been hoping for and working for a long time, and I certainly hope that it happens. I think that part of the pressure on the administration to agree to a law that changes things dramatically is because of the pressure of the lawsuit. So, you know, one of the things one of the dynamics that happens here is that if the government is afraid that they might lose in the courts, then they run to Congress to try to see if they can rearrange things a little bit and make those cases harder. And that's definitely something they've done before. That's how we got, you know, retroactive immunity for the telephone companies, was because the courts were looking pretty closely at our claims against AT&T, and the government and AT&T went to Congress and got a fat immunity for the telcos out of that. So that dynamic is definitely something to pay attention to. I'm not very good at predicting the future.
Of course.
I do think that it's possible to fix this problem with a court decision. It's possible to fix this problem with Congress. And I think these two things work together. I think that a judge that sees that Congress is concerned about this is more likely to feel comfortable throwing it out. And I think that Congress members who are worried about this feel more comfortable to write stronger legislation if they think the courts are looking at this askance. So I feel like they're reinforcing. So we don't have to pick one or the other. We keep pushing on all fronts. And hopefully, you know, one will give or the other will give in a way that will get us some relief, because we can get relief both ways.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I have to say, on my own behalf, that I've gotten so frustrated with obstruction and dysfunction in Congress that such a common sense point hadn't occurred to me. People can find out lots more over at EFF.org. Cindy, thank you so much for your time today. It's an honor to speak with you. You guys are doing amazing work.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with Victoria Jones of Talk Radio News and your calls next. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. For our Free Speech TV viewers, let's go with Tom in Tucson, Arizona. Tom, listening at freespeech.org.
If four carrier task forces are taken out of use and put in dry dock, the $100 billion that would be realized from that could be used to pay off the college debt of those people who graduated from college but cannot move forward with their lives because of that college debt.
Tom, that's an excellent point. It's so, very FDR.
Yeah, and how much did you, no, you said do you take four carriers off of the water, put them in dry dock, and how much would that save?
Support ship. $100 billion.
Wow.
Wow.
That's an incredible number.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with it, Tom. If you listen to the Tom Hartman program regularly, you've probably heard it here, but you know where FDR goes through how much a plane, a bomb, et cetera, and how much that could pay for
Eisenhower.
Oh, excuse me. See,
no
thank
worries.
You, Shane.
No worries.
Super producer Shano over there. But Tom, that's an excellent point, and it is an issue that affects so many people and our entire economy. I think that's a great suggestion. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
See, I had to know it was Eisenhower because that's how it's labeled.
Yes.
So for me to find them, that's how I learned the names.
Yes, you actually get to see the names of the
yes,
clips. I
exactly.
just get to hear them.
Right.
And by the way, for anybody who is waiting on the phone here, please be a little patient because I'm a little bit shorter than Tom. So it's very hard to see his computer screen here and read your points and get to your calls in a quick manner.
Okay.
So let's go with Dan watching on DirecTV, Free Speech TV in Tell City, Indiana. Dan, thanks for watching the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to talk about infrastructure today. They want to spend millions, maybe even billions of dollars bombing. Mm-hmm. And with these airstrikes, killing innocent women and children, and they won't even put a dollar into rebuilding the infrastructure, a crumbling infrastructure in the country. And
yep.
It would create thousands, hundreds of thousands of jobs. And at the beginning of the year, they didn't the Republicans didn't want to renew unemployment. It's, mm-hmm. He could also, by creating jobs, do what Roosevelt did with the WPA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's an excellent point. I don't know how things are in your neighborhood, but it makes me think of the water pipe, Shane.
Oh, yeah.
It just busted.
59 years old.
Yeah.
Also, this just occurred to me before I said, the last time the minimum wage was raised, do you know when that was?
Was that during the Iraq War authorization?
That was after the Democrats took over the House and the Senate in 2006, and George Bush wanted more emergency funding for the Iraq War. So they attached the increase in the minimum wage. Maybe we need to start doing that with this one as well. We could actually get some things done. I still think we should be able to get them done without also bombing another country.
Yeah.
But if we're going to be doing this and the president's going to do it anyway,
let's get
the unemployment extension on there. Let's get some relief for student loans. Let's get some infrastructure building.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, if they want to spend $500 million bombing another country, let's spend some of that building back up our nation here at home. Dan, thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Indiana. We'll be right back with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. Me, Danielle, and Shano sitting in for Tom today. And joining us now, as they do every day, is the one, the only, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thank you so much for joining us. What's in the news today?
Well, thank you very much. I just ducked out of the White House briefing with Josh Earnest. And obviously a lot of different issues being discussed today. At the top of the list was ISIS and the latest on that. And one of the things that was up today is Secretary of State John Kerry, who today is in Turkey. It really is one of those, you know, if it's Friday, it must be Turkey, which I guess it should be Thursday if it's Turkey. But anyway, if it's Friday, it's Turkey. And yesterday it was Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, where he had a closed-door meeting with 10 Arab nations and secured a communique of support from them, strong support for the campaign against ISIS. To ultimately destroy ISIS. But from what I've read about it, there's some fairly airy language in it, because it talks about that they will, for example, do their share. And then it talks about something as appropriate, joining in the many aspects. So I got a chance to ask Josh Earnest about this and said, well, that this language seems a bit amorphous. And what does it mean they're going to do? What commitments do we actually have from them, besides that Saudi Arabia is going to host where they're going to train the Syrian rebels? And he said he wasn't going to get ahead of what the individual countries were going to do, that they would make those announcements themselves, which I take to read that they haven't got any commitments.
Yeah, that's certainly what it sounds like to me. There's also, I don't know if you've spoken to Tom about it, but there's been some links between Saudi Arabia and the funding of ISIS. Was that discussed at all? Did that come up?
That's already come up. The Associated Press, I think it was AP or Reuters, have brought that up. Also Qatar and Kuwait. That's already come up, and of course that's a concern. But one of the things that they have undertaken to do in this communique, there's a good piece about it in the New York Times today, that they've undertaken to do is to, crack down on funding to ISIS. So how they're going to do that, I don't know. Sounds like maybe they could do it over the dinner table.
Yeah, it's very strange to me that if we have at least even reasonable evidence that Saudi Arabia or parts thereof was funding ISIS, that now we're going to trust them to train the very soldiers that are fighting ISIS.
Well, I don't know, though. They're hosting. I don't know that they're doing the training.
They're just providing the location?
Providing the location. So that led me to my second question, which was that the CIA has now come out with analysis saying that there are up to 31,000 ISIS fighters, because of a recruitment surge. And so Josh Earnest came back and said yes, and he had his notes ready on this, that there are 20 to 31,500 ISIS fighters due to a recruitment surge. And I said, well, do you think that you can muster sufficient trainable Syrian rebels to take them on?
And his response to that?
Well, it wasn't really clear. It was a bit, I thought it was unclear, so I asked it again in a follow-up, and so he said that the response to ISIS was bigger than merely military. It was diplomatic, it was this, it was that, and he listed four or five different things. And, of course, it is. It is bigger than simply military, and, of course, they are taking them on in other places than Syria, but it's Syria where the fighting is going to be done, and it is the Syrian rebels who they're hoping to do it. So, and the other piece of it is, and I didn't get a chance to ask this, is that you've got to be not only trainable, but you've got to be hungry for it, and you've got to be mean.
Yeah, especially against a force like ISIS. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that is obviously the biggest story in the news, and it's something I think everybody is keeping an eye on. Is there other big things that we need to know about?
Yes, there are other big things that we need to know about. There are a number of things that are interesting. One other interesting thing, well, the U.S. has imposed some sanctions on Russia. Just hit this quickly because it gets very in the weeds-ish. But the U.S. has targeted Russia's largest bank and 10 government-run defense and energy firms in a new round of sanctions today, which is the same day that the European Union's new round of sanctions has hit them. That's over the country's involvement in Ukraine. And it limits those firms' access to Western technology and financial markets. And I think these are going to bite. It hits defense, it hits energy, and it hits banking. So we'll see if they bite or not. Also, this is interesting. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington has set up the first federal unit in the nation to identify and investigate cases that ended in wrongful convictions.
Hmm. That is very interesting.
Yeah, it's called the Conviction Integrity Unit, and it follows the vacating of five convictions from the 1980s after federal prosecutors in Washington reviewed evidence of the cases. And so they're going to review cases in which defendants convicted of violent felonies can offer new evidence like DNA testing that may establish innocence.
Now, is this only going to be for death penalty cases? Like, we have the Innocence Project that often provides inmates accused of serious crimes some legal defense. Is this for anybody who would be accused of a violent crime?
Well, it says serious felonies in the story that I have. So I only have serious felonies. It does not say that it's only death penalties. And the example that's given to me is the exoneration of Donald Gates, who was a Washington, D.C. man who was convicted in 1982 of a rape and murder, in part on hair evidence. And then DNA testing, which wasn't available then, proved in 2009 that he was innocent. So they are sharing its results with defense lawyers and the Mid-Atlantic Innocence Project. But it's not clear to me whether they are only death penalty cases or whether they are other kinds of serious felonies.
I think that's really interesting. So many people are behind bars who are later proven innocent, and sometimes for decades upon decades. I wonder, I can't help but wonder if they're going to take a second look at Don Siegelman's case.
I don't know. It's very interesting. A number of prosecutors' offices have established units like this in recent years, including the Manhattan DA and the Dallas County DA in Texas.
Well, that would be at the top of my list if they're going to be reviewing cases that should be declared innocent. Thank you so much, Victoria.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Free-Don is the website to check out information on the case we were just talking about. Back with more after this break.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Me, Danielle, and Shano sitting in today for Tom Hartman. You may have noticed this week, Wednesday specifically, that some internet sites you regularly visit had a special graphic that showed a circle loading and loading and loading and loading. And although those graphics didn't actually slow down sites, they wanted to point out what could happen if net neutrality is not protected. Joining us now is Tim Carr, the Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press. You can check out their work at freepress.net. Tim, how did the Internet slowdown day go? Was it a huge success?
It was a huge success. We're very happy that so many companies, so many advocacy organizations, and so many websites and individuals participated. We had sent more than 700,000 comments to the FCC, and overall there were more than 2 million letters that were sent to members of Congress and nearly 300,000 phone calls. So it was a day of mass activism for net neutrality, and it united tech companies with civil liberties, advocacy organizations, free speech advocacy organizations with, you know, people who have, you know, blogs and just do all sorts of things and businesses via the Internet behind one cause, and that's real net neutrality protections for Internet users.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the greatest new ways to protest an action. I know with SOPA and PIPA, previous legislation that was being protested against. There was the internet blackout, and lots of people put up graphics for that, and it did have an effect. Do you think this could have the same effect and get FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler to actually support some real regulation?
Well, that's certainly the hope. And, you know, it's I think it's become clear since the Federal Communications Commission started this process. They earlier this year proposed a rule that's very unpopular that would allow them to slow down some websites, allow Internet service providers to slow down some websites and prioritize others. And that was news of that proposal first came out in February. And in the 7 months since, there has been this amazing outpouring from the American public in support of net neutrality and against this proposal at the FCC. We've sent more than a million comments to the FCC, and it's interesting because the process that the FCC has is they open up a public docket. They say, hey, we're considering doing this thing. What do you think? And they allow the public to comment, and there's a group called the Sunlight Foundation, which deals with government transparency issues, that actually went in and looked at the millions of comments that were in there and found out that 99% of the people commenting said that they supported net neutrality. So you would think that if the chairman were then to decide against net neutrality, that would be a massive violation of the public interest.
Yeah, absolutely. Even just a few weeks ago when he was speaking at a speech at 1776, which is a D.C.-based tech incubator, Tom Wheeler himself said, in fact, that the broadband market is not competitive and that the consumers have no choice. This is another issue in the whole FCC role and net neutrality, in that if these huge companies get so much power, they have control over our internet speeds and our ability to view certain websites, and it's also their job to prevent these companies from getting bigger, isn't it?
It is the FCC's job to protect the interests of consumers, and when you're talking about the internet, you're really talking about the interests of internet users. And unfortunately, in the United States, we've kind of let a number of companies, very powerful companies, in fact, it's a pretty small handful, companies like Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, really dictate internet policy in Washington. They spend millions and millions of dollars on lobbyists. They spend millions more on campaign contributions, and they get to dictate media policy. And what's a result of that is that we have now an internet marketplace where people have very few choices, where we're paying very high prices for internet access, certainly by comparison to other developed countries around the world, and we're not getting the speeds that many people want. And so we have a problem where the FCC, which has been captive to the industry for so many years, has created a policy framework that has ultimately harmed internet users.
Yeah. Absolutely. I know there's only one choice, really maybe one or two, in the area that we live in. And a lot of these companies, Comcast, Verizon, AT&T that you mentioned, also offer their own content, which gets, you know, full circle right back to the net neutrality issue, where I think it's a reasonable concern that independent sites, independent news organizations, independent bloggers, et cetera, have to be, excuse me, very fearful that their information is going to be almost unreachable if something isn't done about net neutrality.
The issue of net neutrality is quite simple. It is about who is going to control the future of communications. If we lose net neutrality, then you'll see these powerful companies. And you're right, you have a company like Comcast, which is not just an internet provider. It's a cable television company that just so happens to own a lot of content. It merged with NBC Universal about 3 years ago. So it has its own interest in favoring some content over the other. So if you're a company like Netflix, or if you're just a startup that wants to stream video over the internet, Comcast might have a problem with that because, of course, Comcast is in the business of providing video television for its users. And so the temptation for a company like Comcast to discriminate, to block access to competing websites, to slow their services in a way that makes them non-competitive, that temptation is so great that we do need these baseline protections that ensure that we as Internet users, whenever we go online, can choose what websites and services we want. All we want our ISP to do is to sell us a certain speed of service and then get out of our way. Once we're online, we can connect with any content that we want to. We can share content that we want to, as long as it's legal, mind you, and do that without any interference from our Internet service provider.
Now, has there been any, for lack of a better term, feel coming from the FCC on how they may rule on this? Is there any type of insider information, any indication that they could regulate Internet like a utility, how many people say that it should be regulated?
Well, I mean, it's what we're asking for is that they restore a common carriage classification to Internet service providers. Now, a lot of people have said, well, that means you're going to turn a company like Comcast into a utility. But in fact, common carriage is not a utility regulation. It is a regulation that is common throughout the economy. And so when you hear that term utility or, you know, strong regulations of the Internet, that usually is coming from the cable industry itself. Common carriage is a light touch that protects free speech over private networks. If we live in a world where, you know, their scale of free expression has never been larger.
Yes.
You consider the numbers of people who are communicating via the Internet these days. It's in the factor of hundreds of millions. The problem that we have is that most of us are communicating via private networks. And in order for us to protect free speech over private networks, we have to make sure that these network providers are common carriers. That is, that they carry all information without discrimination.
Well, Tim, thank you very much for breaking it down for us. We're thrilled to hear that Internet Slowdown Day was a success and people can find out how they can get involved at freepress.net. Thanks so much, Tim.
My pleasure.
Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy at freepress.net. Back with more in just a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we'll be back to your calls right after this, 866-987-THOM. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. In our Free Speech TV break, let's go with Paul watching on Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in South Lyon, Michigan. Thanks so much for watching the Tom Hartman Program, Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Danielle. It's great to see you on TV. You and Shane are doing a great job.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
You're going to make me blush.
I'm an economist, and you brilliantly brought up an idea I've been pushing, that when billionaires become too greedy, it's bad for everyone. Republican economics, which I know is an oxymoron, is give billionaires more money and everyone will benefit. Well, that's not true. Take the guy who owns Papa John's, for example, who supports Republicans. Yes, Republicans will give him lower taxes and lower labor costs, but in the long run, who does he think is going to buy his pizzas when billionaires own everything and working people can't afford pizza? Does he think billionaires will start buying thousands of pizzas? I don't think so.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, this is our economy at stake.
Was it Neumeier, a more liberal billionaire who said, you know, I can only buy a certain number of pairs of pants per year. If you give me tons and tons and tons of more money, I'm not going to buy more jeans. And I think it's the same thing Paul's talking about here.
Exactly. He's a smart billionaire.
Yeah.
Well, they're probably all pretty smart. That's the scary, except for the ones
greed gets in the way of their brains.
Well, exactly.
They're short-sighted. You know, they don't look at the big picture. They look at next week or next month. You know,
and Reagan going back to paying these executives with stock options is what makes them able to be so short-sighted. Because when they benefit from stock prices going through the roof very quickly, which isn't always great, it's kind of like losing weight. You want to lose a couple pounds a week. When corporations make money at this exponential rate, it cannot be supported because they can't build the infrastructure and the people and the buildings to keep it up. The CEO who's made a ton of money on their stock options is gone 6 months later, and the company is still sitting there screwed.
Yeah,
exactly right. And the Republicans have done a good job of convincing millionaires and even multimillionaires that they're working for them, and they're really not. You know, those people are getting shortchanged by Republican policies.
That is an excellent point that I don't think many people consider, that the Republicans are so self-interested. And it may seem like they're working for the millionaires and billionaires, but they're only working for themselves as millionaires and billionaires.
Yeah.
You know, how to
right.
benefit themselves.
Like, it goes back to the question we should be asking everyone running for Congress right now.
Yeah. Why do you want to be?
Why do you want to be a congressman? Why do you want to be a senator? Why?
To protect billionaires, right?
It would be interesting to get their answers. Now, I know they're going to meander and say, well, for the betterment of blah, 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 and the lower regulations and open up, blah, blah, blah. But come on, we're smart enough to see through that.
I think so, too. Paul, thank you. Thank you very much for calling, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in South Lyon, Michigan. Sorry, Paul, I accidentally hit the hang-up button a little too quickly. Do we have time for another call?
A quick one.
All right, a real quick one. Let's go with Jesse in Miami, Florida, watching on Free Speech TV on the Dish Network.
Hi, both of you. I echo the good job you guys are doing from the previous caller.
Oh, thank you.
He pretty much summed up what I was going to say. We got a problem with Congress and the economy, and it's basically is in the government, the people there don't want democracy to work. That should be an idea why nothing's not working,
yep.
And that should be immoral.
Excellent point, Jesse. Sorry to cut it so short there. Jesse watching on Free Speech TV in Miami, Florida. Thanks so much for watching. We'll be right back with more. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and I, me, Danielle, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Tom is in Seattle. And if you are in the area, please go and check out the Money, Politics, and Saving Our Democracy event by Yes Magazine. It's their fourth annual celebration. It's happening tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the Town Hall, Seattle. And for more information, you can go to yesmagazine.org. And for anybody who didn't catch it earlier, one of the reasons we're sitting in today for Tom, besides him not being here, is we do have our own show.
We do.
In addition to working for Tom.
And our website actually had that little spitty thing on it yesterday.
We did.
We did that as well.
Well, you did.
Well, yeah, sure.
Shane did.
Yeah.
But you could check that out at talkingleft.com if you are so inclined. But it is Anything Goes Friday. So
sure.
We want to keep sticking to your calls. And if you're listening and you have something on your mind, 866-987-THOM. But let's go with Marty in Evergreen Park, listening on WCPT. Thanks so much for listening, Marty.
Hey, guys. Well, you guys are doing a great job, and thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely. You think it's interesting that Congress for anybody who didn't hear it, because I said it on a free speech break, it is very hard for me to read Tom's screen here that the call screening software is on, because I'm about 4 or 5 inches shorter than Tom. So, but Marty, you think think it's interesting?
Yeah, basically that the one issue that seems to be uniting this Congress right now is going after ISIS group. I was reading a statement that Marco Rubio was actually saying that fully defeating ISIS is a realistic goal. And even though he says that it's just reality to acknowledge that a complete ISIS defeat may not be possible, but that we must continue no matter what it takes and no matter how long it takes. So I think the war hawks in the Congress are really going to rally behind the president, oddly enough, over this specific issue.
Yeah, if they're willing to rally behind the president, why aren't they willing to vote for it?
I think that that's just a matter of time, because I think I think they're going to push the patriots, idealism, that eventually people aren't going to want to be on record not voting for this for the time being. Oddly enough, I was looking up just to kind of figure out, how much would something like this cost? And NBC had a little blip on this, basically stating that it's probably going to cost anywhere between $20 and $40 billion a year.
That seems on the low side to me.
To go after ISIS. Yeah, they were saying like $100 million a week or more if airstrikes are extended into Syria. and that all the funds are going to be pulling from this overseas contingency operations fund.
Yet they wouldn't let Bernie Sanders pull from that fund to help veterans.
Right, because I would imagine that the number they're coming up with doesn't factor in those long-term costs like veterans themselves. I think that Jack Kingston had it right when it comes to why Republicans don't want to vote on this. He said that they're in the best position of all because they get what they want. They're going to war. They don't have to put their name on a vote. They don't have to describe the lengths to which the president can go. Therefore, no matter what the president does, they still can criticize him. And if it goes well, you say, well, I supported it all along. They are leaving all doors open. And perhaps after the election, they may, I would think, vote, to, if anything, to limit his power. But for right now, they're not going to do anything. And Jack Kingston is a Republican from Georgia, who lost the primary for governor, I believe, down there. So he's now been freed up to actually speak his mind about Republicans. And if they want the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Marty, what do you think?
Oh, I think you're spot on. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, they're probably going to, you know, behind the scenes say, oh, yeah, you know, this is great, but not officially put their name on it, primarily because they don't want to officially have their name on something that
right.
supports something the president is doing. But I just think it's so funny that you're hearing all these talking points going to and from basically supporting this effort, but
yep.
nobody's going to officially
I
put
just,
their name on it.
I just don't want to see the people who are refusing to speak out right now tell me 5 years from now how they were against this before it
right.
started.
And on top of it, think about if the Republicans are interested in making money for the military-industrial complex, they've succeeded in doing that without tying themselves to the president. And you remember George Bush was talking about how he'd get all this political capital from being a wartime president. So, yeah, we have the Cindy Sheehan clip that Tom plays often, where Bush, before he was elected, said, I'm going to do war right because I'm going to be a wartime president. I'm going to see that way. I'm going to get all that political capital, and then I'm going to use it. Conservatives, Republicans, want to make sure that we have a wartime president that has zero political capital, zero. And that's – they're trying to play it that way, and they're doing an excellent job of it. They have scared the heck out of the American people. They have driven us into a war. Yet at the same time, they are still criticizing our president. Watch John McCain. You know, we only have about 10 seconds, by the way.
Oh, okay. Only
Sorry
about 10
that.
Seconds, so I won't go to another call.
Oh, wait, no. We have a minute time.
Oh, okay.
See, that's what happens when I have to push buttons and talk.
Push buttons and talk. But
some producers who do this do it so well.
Yeah.
It's so easily.
Thank you very much, Marty, listening on WCPT in Illinois. Let's go with Linda. Sorry, we only have just about a minute, but are you calling, watching on Free Speech TV in
yes.
Pompano Beach, Florida? Are you? Is this in reference to the Ray Rice
yes,
situation?
Yes, it is. Well, I believe that everybody... It's everybody's business to get involved when you see domestic abuse because you can change a life and you can and do it without even knowing that you're doing it. We did it 30 years ago for a very good friend of ours. She is happily married now. She has raised her two sons. She had it very well hidden until one night it spilled out into the street in front of us. And that's when, as a neighborhood, you all stick together. We housed her. We made sure she had food for her children. We made sure she had a place to stay, and she felt safe.
Yep.
And it's everybody's business to get involved.
Well, and I think...
And I just want to say, you know, she will wake up. I'm not blaming her. But him, he needs help.
Well, I think for many, many... Thank you, Linda.
And you saved a life.
Yeah. Thank you.
It was more than helping. It was saving a life.
Absolutely. And I think that's a big part of the issue for many victims of domestic abuse is having somewhere to turn, and people like Linda can help make that possible. I think that's an excellent point. We'll be back with more of your calls in just a few minutes. 866-987-THOM.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Lots of great calls on the board. If you want to add your voice into 866-987-THOM. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Danielle here, along with Shano, filling in for the great Tom Hartman.
Who will be back.
Who will be back Monday.
We're not.
No worries. And it is Anything Goes Friday, so we are sticking with your calls. And let's see where we left off.
So technically our callers are filling in.
Yes.
Or Tom's
excellent,
callers.
Excellent point. Starting with Roseanne, listening on Sirius in Winter Haven, Florida. Or Rosanna, is it? Roseanne. And you had a comment on the prescription coverage gap?
Yeah, I am retired, and I'm living on Social Security, and I'm what's called an uncontrolled diabetic,
mm-hmm.
and I take two different kinds of insulin, and when I'm not in the gap, plus my other medications, it's around $200 to $250 a month. When I'm out of the gap, which for me starts in like April or May because of the expense, my drugs are over $800 a month.
Now, is this gap that you're talking about the Medicare prescription D?
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, is this going to get any better for you? Because my understanding of the Affordable Care Act is part of the provisions in there are going to tighten that gap to make it smaller and eventually get rid of it. Have you seen, I don't know when that starts, that hasn't started yet?
It has not started yet, and what they're saying is Bernie Sanders, God bless his soul, is trying to pass a law to eliminate it or at least cut it in half. Right now, I won't see any really appreciable change until 2018.
Wow. It just doesn't make sense to me, Roseanne, in the richest country on earth where people like yourself should even have to deal with this problem.
And because of the expense, I literally cannot get these prescriptions every month. One of the insulin alone is $180 a month when I'm in the gap, and the other one, which is called Victoza, is over $300. Now, that's not counting anything else I take.
Yep.
So I have to decide each month, okay, I'll get the insulin this month and take it every other day, which is not good, of course. And maybe next month I might try the Victoza, but then I can't get any of the other prescriptions. So I'm in a no-win situation. So I just wanted to bring it up and let people know that this is true. I mean, it really happens. And for people who are on Social Security, it tears you up.
Yes, absolutely. And yet, at the same time, we're going to go and spend millions of dollars in,
billions.
You know, blowing stuff up instead of helping good people like yourself. Roseanne, thank you for the call. I'm so sorry you're in that situation. Yeah, and you have an election coming up. The one major difference, hopefully, is, you know, you can get some people who listen.
I'm an advocate on voting because it's so important. And I love Obama, and I know that he has his faults, and I don't agree on everything. But I think that he is the best thing we've had since John Kennedy.
I think that's well said, and I certainly hope your situation gets better
and
a lot sooner than 2018.
And of course, Senator Sanders working on that.
Absolutely.
Does not surprise me.
But thank you for listening on Sirius in Winter Haven. Let's go with Mitch, who's watching on Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. I don't have a city for you, Mitch. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Damascus, Oregon.
Well, all right. Mitch from Oregon. And you had some comments on Congress.
Sure. Fire them all. Get rid of all obstructionists, the Senate, Congress. The definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and expecting that something will change. Our Senate Congress members are domestic terrorists. Boehner shut down the American government to make a point. This cost the taxpayers, American taxpayers, $20-plus billion. That would have paid for medical coverage, food subsidies for Americans, the working poor. This is ridiculous. Fire them all. Start new. Get back to basics and put real people in, not someone who's never had a budget or worked or raised a family on $30,000.
Well, I think there are some members of Congress that I would like to see sticking around, but
yes,
there are plenty I would agree with you on.
And so often we see these polls where people are upset with Congress, but I love my congressman. That is different this time around. I've been noticing and people have been talking about. This is kind of a throw the bums out kind of election. Which way that goes is going to depend entirely on turnout. And this is a midterm. So turnout is vital because we really can make a difference. One of those shocking revolutionary changes in this election, you wouldn't think it because all the pundits are out there saying this was definitely going to go this way and 2/3 chance it's going to go that way. But we don't know that. Not a single vote has been cast yet. It is still in our hands.
Right.
And if we don't take advantage of that, then it's just going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy by the pundits. we have the ability to change that. And if we want to throw the bums out, we can.
And as Tom says, quite often, get involved. You know, run for your local district, become a precinct committee member so that you have control over who is in that election. Because
right.
oftentimes the party picks it and you don't have the type of choice that you would like to. But, you know, Mitch, I understand the sentiment. I really do. I try not to get to the point of,
right.
of throw my hands up and do nothing because that's not an option.
And if you think about it, if we throw all the quote-unquote bums out, we lose Elizabeth Warren, we lose Bernie Sanders, we lose Sherrod Brown. You know, I can go on and on and on, the amazing people that we would lose, and that's not acceptable to me.
Right, but I certainly, I can understand why Mitch, you feel the way you do.
Absolutely.
And thank you very much for watching on Free Speech TV and for calling in to talk to us. We appreciate it. Let's go with Michael in Flagstaff, Arizona. I'm guessing you're listening on Sirius, Michael?
Actually, no, I'm just listening on my phone, but I was in the car radio for the moment.
Oh, okay. And you had some thoughts on education.
Yeah, so I'm 27. I live in Flagstaff, obviously. I go to the community college because NAU doesn't offer the degree I'm expanding my horizons for. My issue is that we, as a society, feel that we should all be educated, but what we're being taught is what I feel is, like, negative and what's the opposite of proactive? Just not reasonable. Like, you see everywhere from high school to college where we boast and we talk about things that have nothing to do with education. Completely. And then,
can you give us an example?
Yeah.
I
kind of
understand
one
you're
example
going.
So maybe we know, like, are you talking about specific classes?
Well, I was just giving, like, a reason why I called. And, like, my biggest issue right now, what I have in education, is how much it costs. Like,
yeah.
We talk about how much money, like, you guys have been talking all day, like, money being spent on war, et cetera. We can't fix any of that unless we fix our education system. Like, we can't have an internal structure if we can't have 10-year-olds that can't spell versus a 30-year-old that can't spell. And I don't mean, like, grammar like that, but, like, the average person that I meet on a daily basis has no idea what is going on, and I feel that's because of education, because we're taught nothing.
Well, a lot of those corporations, you know, public education might be technically a public service. It's a commons. But corporations have managed to embed themselves in so many ways, like the writing of our textbooks, the educating of our teachers, and ways that influence what information is presented to students. I mean, we've seen civics completely disappear from education.
And also, if you cut taxes like Bush did, at the federal level, less money goes to states. States have less money than goes to communities. You have a housing bubble burst because Wall Street banksters, property values go down. You have less money to put towards your schools. If you have less funds, you don't have as great education, you start cutting. What do you cut? You know, and a lot of times it's the practical things.
Yes.
I think the things you can do in school that will really translate directly to a job, to knowing how to do something. And then, of course, civics. An awareness of what's going on around you so you can critically think and make decisions for yourself instead of just eating the propaganda whole.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that we could make education more sustainable with getting rid of some classes like Michael was talking about that maybe are more intended to make colleges profit than to actually educate students.
Oh, you're talking about, like, buffering, saying you have to take X number of non-electives.
So I think there's a lot of good points in that statement, and I can certainly relate, Michael, on the student loans situation. So
Time for a jubilee.
I think it'll get there on its own if we don't. Do we have time for another call?
We do.
All right. Let's. Thank you very much, Michael. Appreciate you listening. And let's go with Brian, listening on KGOE in Eureka, California. Brian, you had some thoughts on net neutrality?
Yes. Good afternoon. Just a couple of quick points on net neutrality. First and foremost, the airwaves belong to us, not the corporations. And I don't know why, you know, he put this person in charge, but the head of the FCC, from my understanding, was a former lobbyist for the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I hope we can, you know, thwart that and get net neutrality through. One thing on a bigger issue that will impact net neutrality, war around the world, whatever you want to call it, Obama has had, as you know, since day one, a difficult road to hoe with this Congress. You know, whether it's Mitch McConnell, you know, pledging to, you know, send this guy down in flames, whatever. He's had a tough, you know, road of it. If the Congress does flip Republican you can just guarantee more lame duck presidency and stuff like that. What I advocate for is, 25% or less people turn out to the polls in this midterm, Republicans got a lock on it. If we can get even 50% of the registered Democrats, progressives, independents to get out, if you don't want to actually go down and pull the lever and vote, vote by mail, do something. But if we can flip this Congress to a more progressive, Congress that will work with him, I would imagine you'll see minimum wage go up. You'll see expanded health care. You'll see net neutrality.
Brian, I think you are right on the money, and I think it's one of the most important jobs we have as citizens, and we do need to get more people involved. We'll be right back with more of your calls. Big thanks to Brian listening on KGOE.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So how do we get more people involved, more people to vote? Any ideas? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program on our Free Speech TV break here. And let's go with William, watching on DirecTV in Washington State. William, how do you say the name of your city?
It's Chimicum.
Chimicum. All right. And you had some thoughts on the water problems in the Southwest and the drought there?
Yeah. You purify water in 180 feet of gravel.
Okay.
So if we took salt water from the ocean by pipe, piped it over to above Death Valley, dumped that water onto paddle-driven generators, and then run an aqueduct down to the valley, which would take about 50 miles, we can harness by paddle wheel all the way to the valley floor. The water gets to the valley floor, and we can harness up to probably 100 nuclear power plants for energy if we wanted to do it that bad. Then we take water seeps into the soil. We pump that fresh water that we drill deep water wells to, and we pipe that to all the surrounding states so that we increase our fresh water. So we're lowering the sea level. So we're fighting that while we're generating energy 24 hours a day.
Yeah. William, I mean, all of this, it sounds absolutely wonderful, but I have to be honest, I'm just not technically sufficient to...
Yeah, this is definitely one of those Tom questions, or Tom comments, but if I can just ask a real quick question. Getting that salt water to Death Valley, where does the energy come from to do that?
Siphoning it, just like a gas tank. You take the hose or at the end of the pipe and you...
Yeah. So the capillary effect all the way level. Capillary effect all the way there.
Yeah.
Huh.
What you're doing is there's a way of doing it with a large pipe, but you're using small inlets and small outlets. You're not using a huge one. You keep it, make sure that the inlets well down below so that you never get air into it. You never have to worry about cavitation.
Yeah, William, do you have a website or something that people can check out information on this?
Well, actually, it's called thebestnewenergies.com.
Cool.
All right. Well, hopefully somebody listening will take part in that. I apologize. I am not the person who can intelligently discuss that kind of thing. I will say that a friend of ours is working on a similar project. We know him by the name of Snorky, so I'll just give out that name. But working on trying to solve the drought problem in the Southwest, and you can check out his project at islandconnect.com/partner/IIC.
And you have some information. He's in Hawaii with a bunch of other scientists.
Yes, and he is a really smart, really smart guy. But I'm sure there's a lot of people working on this. I apologize. I am just...
Well, that is not
my wheelhouse.
I understand it basically that, of course, like well water, you get it down far enough, the ground itself will filter it. But getting that salt water out to Death Valley, that's what I don't quite understand.
Yeah.
That's the part that confuses
thankfully,
me.
Thankfully, there are better minds than mine working on this problem, and it's something we definitely need to address. You know, they're talking about a 35-year drought, the possibility of that. This is something we need to get a hold of. It's an excellent topic. So we'll be back with more in just a few minutes. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Me, Danielle, and Shane are filling in today. And if you like what you're hearing from us, you can check out more at talkingleft.com. We do our show on the weekends. You can listen to it at all kinds of great places, including the station here in D.C., We Act Radio and Progressive Voices.
Netroots
and
Radio.
Netroots Radio and SoFlo Radio. So go and check it out, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. It's not quite as as intelligent as Tom's show, but we do our best.
So. No one's as intelligent, I think, I swear.
Yes. We have just a few more minutes of the show, so I wanted to get to as many callers as we could. Let's go with Linda, listening on 880 The Revolution in Asheville, North Carolina. Linda, you wanted to discuss the Citizens United vote.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is that, you know, my senators are Kay Hagan and Richard Burr. Kay Hagan signed on to the bill that would do an amendment. Richard Burr, when I called his office, has said his staffer is opposed to amending the Constitution and instead is looking at different ways to, I guess, stop or control the flow of money. So my question is this. I know that there are good Democrats like Warren and Udall and Brown who would actually like to see Citizens United overturned. And I wonder how much cover does this provide for Democrats? Because an amendment would be practically impossible, if not years away, to get. And the other question is, if Congress did get their act together and did try to set up some limits on campaign funding, is this just a moot point because it's now illegal because of the ruling by the Supreme Court?
You know, I've heard other people ask similar questions in response to the Citizens United amendment, Tom Udall's amendment that was voted on this week, whether it was whether Democrats would put it forward now knowing that it could never pass, whether Republicans agreed to allow it to go forward simply to tie the Democrats up for a week. Shane, do you have...
Yeah, well, first of all, to get to the last question first, because we are amending the Constitution, the reason we are trying to amend the Constitution, why you and I are for the Tom Udall amendment, is that the Supreme Court itself made this necessary. So when she asked, you know, wouldn't this amendment itself be mooted by the Supreme Court? And actually, it's quite the reverse. The reason we're amending the Constitution is to overrule the Supreme Court, because we can do that. The Supreme Court, as much as they want to make themselves into the kings and queens, we do have the ultimate say. It's just it's a very long or difficult road. It's not necessarily a long one to get an amendment to the Constitution, which gets to a different part of her question, which was, isn't this nearly impossible? We haven't done it a lot of times in our history. But Tom often talks about the age of voting. That amendment to the Constitution, that it was lowered to the age of 18, and how rapidly that happened. That when there's a popular movement to amend the Constitution, like I believe there actually is with overturning Citizens United, that it can happen quickly and that it will be done. And I really do believe that we will have a 28th Amendment to the Constitution that will give Congress and local and state governments the ability to regulate campaign spending.
Right.
It did not happen this time, but it got a heck of a lot farther than it has before. I think people will... including us, and of course Tom, that's what his speech is about in Seattle, will continue to work on this. It can be done, and don't ever let someone say you can't do it. We can amend our Constitution. In fact, it was specifically contemplated when it was first written that we would amend it all the time. There's this constant fight over in the Supreme Court whether the Constitution is supposed to be read as an originalist, you know, the Scalia side. We'll take the words and what they meant in 1789, and that's how we're supposed to run our country in 2014. Nonsense. Then there's the other side, that the Constitution is this living, breathing document that we're supposed to, that moves over time. And to that I also say, which is the liberal side, I also say nonsense. It wasn't supposed to do either. Jefferson contemplated regular constitutional conventions to amend the Constitution to fit what we need, and we have control over that. Yes, it takes two-thirds of the Congress. Yes, it takes three-quarters of the states, but we can still do that, especially if there's a popular movement behind it, like I think there is here.
I think we can, but I think it's a very fair question. So, Linda, thank you very much for listening on 880 The Revolution in Asheville. Do we have time for another call?
We do.
All right, great. Let's go with Nelson, watching on Free Speech TV in Remmer, maybe, Tennessee. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that city right, Nelson. Nelson?
Nelson.
Watching on Free Speech TV. All right.
He's like, Shane went on too long. That can't be enough time.
You scared them away. All right, let's go with Roger, watching on KTNF in Minneapolis, or listening on KTNF in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Roger, thanks for listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Well, it's a very valuable program, and I just have to say to start that you and Shane do a very creditable job filling Tom's shoes.
You guys are going to make me blush today.
Well, go right ahead and blush. I wanted to follow on some comments from earlier. A fellow called who said that he was an economist. I have translated literally 100 books from various languages, economics texts and writings, working at the University of Minnesota, and have become conversant with a lot of the issues involved. The idea of having yet another pair of genes, if you already own 20, is a rather old one, and it's a very important one for all of us to be equipped with understanding. It's called diminishing marginal utility in economics speech. And one of the interesting aspects of understanding diminishing marginal utility is that it provides a very strong argument for there being a limit to how wealthy people can become. because it really brings in the question, the point at which a thing continues to have value if you already have sufficient.
Roger, I sincerely apologize, but we are running out of time.
He's bringing up no billionaires.
Excellent point, and
no,
I hope you will call back and talk to Tom, because that's that sounds really interesting. I'd love to hear more about those books. I want to quickly remind everybody, Tom's in Seattle, 7:30 tonight at Town Hall Seattle. Go to yesmagazine.org for more information. And a big thanks to Tom and Louise for allowing us to sit in. Big
and
thanks
to Jim and Troy.
Jim and Troy and Sean Taylor, the world's most fabulous producer. Tom will be back on Monday. Thanks so much for spending the day with us. We really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.